And now Diet Coke presents the Lost Lennon Tapes on the Westwood One Radio Network, brought to you by Diet Coke. Enjoy Diet Coke. You're going to drink it just for the taste of it. John Lennon loved sound. It was his art and his passion. Throughout his life, he collected sound, music, conversation, interviews, private moments. By the time of his death, John had literally hundreds of hours of tapes and cassettes in various places around the world. There were early recordings of the Beatles, John's demo tapes, all kinds of interviews he and Yoko had done, a complete chronicle of the Double Fantasy sessions, cassettes of special times at home, John's private life in sound. For years, these tapes have remained in vaults, closets, basements, and safe deposit boxes. But now, by special arrangement with the Lennon Estate, these tapes can finally be heard. Every week for the next year, Westwood One will take you on a journey through this unique sound experience, the Lost Lennon Tapes. Today, a three-hour preview of what's ahead with the series host, John's close friend and confidant, Elliot Mintz. Our incredible journey through the Lost Lennon Tapes begins after this. We now go to the living room of the Dakota in New York City. Here's your host for the Lost Lennon Tapes, Elliot Mintz.
The Dakota. It's one of New York's oldest apartment buildings, and for almost 10 years it was home to John and Yoko. I was fortunate enough to share some time here with them, and lucky enough to be considered a friend. This room, the white room, the living room, will serve as home base for the journey we'll take together. Over the next 3 hours, we'll visit some of the places that were important in John's life in America, from New York to California. And I'll try to give you a broad overview of the wealth of material we found and still are finding every day. All of this has been made possible by special arrangement between Westwood One and Yoko Ono.
Hello, I'm Yoko Ono. Today, I'd like to tell you about this radio series, which will present private tapes of John Lennon. These are tapes that could have been just kept in a vault, never to see the light of the day. Most of them are probably pretty personal stuff, and I definitely had two minds about sharing them with you. But in the spirit of sharing, which John and I always believed in, I decided to make them available to you through the radio. I chose Westwood One because it was the obvious choice, being the biggest and the best radio network. Choosing Elliot Mintz as the host of the series was not so much a choice, I believe, but a karmic destiny. As you all know, Elliot Mintz was a top DJ when he first met John and me. Since then, he has been a good and close friend to the Lennons for the past 15 years. I would not let anybody go into those vaults and take out tapes that I myself do not have the heart to listen to at this time, except it was Elliot. In result, he had to listen to over 100 hours of tapes in the last few months, night and day. Thank you, Elliot.
Our journey starts with one of the earliest of all the tapes, simply marked The Quarrymen, one of the first groups John formed with his school buddies Paul McCartney and George Harrison. This recording of what appears to be John backing up Paul with an old Ray Charles hit may have been a rehearsal, or it may have been a record they made at a local Liverpool shop, since you can actually hear pops and cracks if you listen carefully. But most of the music on the Quarrymen tape is instrumental, their British version of American rock and roll.
Thank you.
This is the kind of music John and the others played in the Cavern in Liverpool, first as the Quarrymen and later as the Beatles. By that time, John and Paul had started writing their own songs, two of which, P.S. I Love You and Love Me Do, became their first single. It was released on October 4th, 1962. 3 weeks later, they went on the radio for their first interview.
Well, it's a very great pleasure for us this evening to say hello to an up-and-coming Merseyside group, the Beatles. And I know their names, and I'm going to try and put faces to them. Now, you're John Lennon, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, that's right.
What do you do in the group, John?
I play harmonica, rhythm, guitar, and vocal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they call it.
Harmonica, rhythm, guitar, and vocal. Then there's Paul McCartney, that's
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's me, yeah.
And what do you do?
Play bass guitar and sing, I think.
Oh,
yeah, that's what they
quite
say.
Quite apart from being vocal.
Yeah, well, yes, yeah.
Then there's George Harrison.
How do you do?
How do you do? What's your job?
Lead guitar and sort of singing.
Mm-hmm. By playing lead guitar, does that mean you're sort of leader of the group, or are you...
No, just... Well, you see, the other guitars, the rhythm.
Yeah.
Ting, ting, so ting, you
see. It's solo guitar, you see. John is, in fact, the leader of the group.
Yeah. I don't know whether we caught that or not, but I hope it went in.
Yeah.
And over in the background here, and also in the background of the group, but making a lot of noise, is Ringo Starr.
Hello.
You're new to the group, aren't you, Ringo?
Yes, 9 weeks now.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I'd like to introduce, if I may, a young disc jockey who helps us out with programmes at Cleaver and Clatterbridge Hospitals. His name is Malcolm Threadgill. He's 16 years old, and I'm sure you'd like to ask some questions from the teenage point of view, Malcolm.
You composed P.S. I Love You and Love Me Do yourself, didn't you?
Yeah.
Who does the composing?
Well,
between you?
It's John and I. We write, you know, sort of the songs between us.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we sort of signed contracts and things to say that, you know, if we
get
sort
equal
of
shares.
Yeah, equal yeah. shares and royalties and things, so that, you know, really we just both write most of the stuff. George did write this instrumental, you know, as we say, but mainly it's John and I. We've written over about 100 songs. But we don't use half of them, you know. We just happened to sort of rearrange Love Me Do and played it to the recording people and P.S. I Love You. And they seemed to quite like it, you know, so that's what we recorded.
That first single ultimately rose to number 17 on the British pop charts, and within a month, the Beatles were back in the studio making what was to be their first album. As John later recalled in one of his taped interviews with me, the entire record was made in one all-night session.
The album being done in one evening was just a matter of finances, and the record company would not let us stay longer than one night in the studio. The first album was recorded in a one long 12-hour session, which the last song to be done was a song called Twist and Shout, which nearly killed me. It was the last song after 12 hours of singing and being in a recording studio for the first time in our lives. And I was always bitterly ashamed of it because I sang it better than that, you know. But now it doesn't bother me. You can hear that I'm just some frantic guy, you know, doing his best. But it always, that was done in 12 hours. But that's because they wouldn't spend any more money, you know. We'll sing it up, baby.
Beatles took England by storm in 1963, not just on record, but also on the radio with a series of live performances. In the summer of that year, the BBC had a special program called Pop Goes the Beatles, hosted by a disc jockey named Rodney Burke. John recorded one of those appearances and saved it on a tape simply marked Rare Lennon with the Beatles.
My name's Rodney Burke. Thank you very
much. It's your fault.
Nice of you to inquire. Now, do you mind? Get back to your own microphone, because here are the Beatles with Sweet Little 16.
They're really rocking in Boston.
The Beatles in a live 1963 radio performance of the Chuck Berry classic, Sweet Little 16.
There's lots more ahead as we continue our voyage through the lost Lennon tapes. Coming up, Beatlemania, John's controversial statements about the Beatles being more popular than Jesus Christ, and a never-heard-before recording of John doing Strawberry Fields. It's the lost Lennon tapes on the Westwood One Radio Network. Now, back to the Lost Lennon Tapes with your host, Elliot Mintz.
I'm standing here in front of the Plaza Hotel in New York City. This is where John and the Beatles spent that frantic night of February 7th, 1964, their first night in America. They'd flown here to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show, and from the moment they stepped off the plane at Kennedy Airport, they were the center of a whirlwind of attention. Their first press conference turned into a mob scene, and tens of thousands of fans lined the streets from JFK Airport to this hotel, hoping to catch a glimpse of John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Beatlemania had hit America. It would follow them everywhere, even on their trip to Australia and the Far East that June. The scene when they arrived in Melbourne was typical.
Any minute now, the Beatles will be arriving at the Southern Cross. Their car is in Bourke Street, and the fans are going really mad. Here they come. Here come the Beatles with a police escort, the crowd surging forward, absolutely out of control. Out here in front of the hotel, behind our cameras, where the crowd is absolutely thick. You cannot see an inch of space. All you can see is heads, baskets, and coloured guernseys. The crowd now has broken down from Collins Street. They're running down Exhibition Street. The Beatles are arriving with a police escort. Two police cars, a mounted police escort, motorcycle police. This is not the Beatles. This is a diversionary measure. This is a police escort without the Beatles. They fooled the fans. The Beatles are making an entrance through the back of the hotel. This is a diversionary measure. The cars are pulling through. The fans are going mad, but the Beatles aren't here. They're around the back of the hotel. And the screams of disappointment coming from the fans as they realise they've been fooled. The Beatles are around the back. They couldn't have possibly got them through this crowd to the front entrance. And the policeman is being knocked off his bike here. He can't get through the crowd. The policeman's off his bike. The crowd absolutely pushing through. The policeman's come off his bike. They're trying to clear a way through. The crowd's gone mad. The car's going through. The sirens are going and it's hysteria.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing, and it's worth it just to hear you.
Toured extensively in 64 and 65, playing historic shows at places like San Francisco's Cow Palace and New York's Shea Stadium. But as time went on, the crowds became uncontrollable, and as John later recalled, for him, the thrill of performing faded away.
It got pretty boring. No, not after the first couple of months. It took years. But I've said this many times. By the time the Beatles hit America, they no longer could play live very well at all, you know. I mean, Hamburg and Liverpool, we'd been used to playing 6 or 8 hours a day or something like that, you know. And, or at least nobody played less than 2 hours, 2 or 3 hours for any gig, you know. And by the time we got here, we'd got down to playing 20 minutes in an English theatre. Yeah, a whole concert. And so that's why the Beatles were famous for doing 15-minute shows. We could speed it up to 15 minutes, you know, over in America, you know, 50,000 people. It seems we'd be off in 15. That was our record. So we got our kicks from seeing how fast we could do the whole show. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's still, we still got into the music.
As the Beatles' music got more complex, so did their relationship with the public. At first, they were the four lads from Liverpool, four clean-cut young men who took the world by storm. Then came stories of drug use, unusual cuts like the one we just heard, Tomorrow Never Knows, and finally, in 1966, a quote of John Lennon's which was taken out of context. In a magazine interview, John was asked about the state of Christianity in the West, in explaining that he thought a lot of young people were leaving the church, he said that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ. The remark caused an uproar, and in August of 1966, at a press conference in Chicago, Lennon tried to explain what he'd meant.
I'll try and tell you. I was sort of deploring the attitude. The thing, I wasn't saying whatever they were saying, I was saying anyway. That's the main thing about it. And I was just talking to a reporter, but she also happens to be a friend of mine and the rest of us. At home, it was a sort of in-depth series she was doing. And so I wasn't really thinking in terms of PR or translating what I was saying. It was going on for a couple of hours, and I just said it as just to cover the subject, you know. And that's, and it really meant what You know, I didn't mean it the way he said it. That's amazing. It's just so complicated. It's gone out of hand, you know. But I just meant it as that. That the Beatles... I wasn't saying the Beatles are better than Jesus or God or Christianity. I was using the name Beatles because I can use them easier. And I was using, you know, because I can talk about Beatles as a separate thing and use them as an example, especially to a close friend. But I could have said TV or cinema or anything else that's popular, or motor cars are bigger than Jesus. But I just said Beatles because, you know, that's the easiest one for me. I just never thought of repercussions. I never really thought of it. I wasn't even thinking, even though I knew she was interviewing me, that she was going to, you know, that it meant anything.
What's your reaction to the repercussions?
Well, when I first heard it, I thought, it can't be true. It's just one of those things like bad eggs in Adelaide and things. And then when I realised it was serious, I was worried stiff. You know, because I knew sort of how it would go on. And the more the things that would get said about it, and all those miserable-looking pictures of me looking like a cynic and that, and they'd go on and on and on, and it'd get out of hand, and I couldn't control it, you know. I can't answer for it when it gets that big, because it's nothing to do with me then.
A disc jockey in Birmingham, Alabama, who really started most of the repercussions, has demanded an apology from you.
He can have it, you know. I apologise to him if he's upset. And he really means it. You know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I said it, really, for the mess it's made. But I never meant it as a lousy or anti-religious thing or anything. You know, and I can't say any more than that. There's nothing else to say, really. You know, no more words. But if an apology, if he wants one, you know, he can have it. I apologize to him.
This is Doug Layton and Tommy Charles reminding you that our fantastic Beatle boycott is still in effect. Don't you forget what the Beatles have said.
Don't forget to take your Beatle records and your Beatle paraphernalia to any one of our 14 pickup points in Birmingham, Alabama, and turn them in this week if possible.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land.
As time went on, John and the other Beatles spoke less and less publicly. Their press conferences often turned into reporters' shouting matches, and the band decided to let their music speak for itself. But during one of their last tours of America, John and Paul led a reporter into the house they were renting, sat down at the piano, and answered questions about their relationship, in particular, how they approached songwriting.
We normally approach it on the M1.
And so we come up, turn past London, and when we get to Scarborough, we feel we're there, as they say.
Well, I guess I asked for it.
No, we just got a very informal approach. We've got no formula at all, you know, for writing songs. We just do it as it happens. Sometimes John can write a line of a song. He can come up and say,
things like that.
He could say that. He could just say that. He could just say that to me, and I could say, "No, John." And
often I disagree with Paul and say, which has been done so many times, it killed it.
But then sometimes, you know, we have a real row, and I say, "Listen here, John. I don't think that's right." But it depends, you know. Sometimes there's a line that he does, and then I do a line. Or sometimes John can write a whole song.
Can I?
Yes, oh, he's a wonder when he gets going. Sometimes I can even do that.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes and she's gone. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you. Train in a station with plasticine pauses with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile. The girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
A John Lennon song which became the center of controversy in 1967. By that time, John's experimentation with drugs was widely reported, and the world was certain Lucy in the Sky was a veiled reference to LSD. The fact that the song was actually inspired by a drawing John's son Julian didn't seem to matter to a public and press bent on sensationalism.
There's lots more fascinating material ahead as we hear about Yoko and the Bed Inns. But in a moment, a version of Strawberry Fields that's never been played in public. All that and more when we continue with the Lost Lennon Tapes on the Westwood One Radio Network. Now, back to the Lost Lennon Tapes. Here's your host, Elliot Mintz.
I'm standing in a room, a storage room of sorts. This is in the basement of the Dakota Building in New York City. I am told that in the old days, this is where they used to stable the horses. This building goes back 70 or 80 years, and down here in the basement, various people who live in the building store different things. And it was here that we found some of the most unusual of John Lennon's tapes. When John would write something for the Beatles, he'd often record a demo and then take it to the others so they could learn their parts. This tape, which had no markings on the box when I first discovered it down here, appears to be the demo for one of John Lennon's classics. Later in this series, we'll play that demo in its entirety and trace its development into the finished track.
Nothing is real, nothing to get hung about. ever.
John wrote Strawberry Fields at a time when his horizons were expanding. He was exploring new ideas, new states of mind. And it was at this time that he met the woman who would change his life, an avant-garde Japanese artist named Yoko Ono. Years later, in a candid conversation, John and Yoko would remember that day in November of 1966 when they first encountered each other.
Now, it's a long story.
Yoko had come
with a smash.
Yeah. Had come to London, or had been invited to London by some group of artists or something called Destruction in Art Symposium. They had some big thing going on in London. And she had an exhibition put on by that gallery, what was it called?
Indica Gallery.
Indica Gallery, Marion Faithfull's. John Dunbar, Marion Faithfull's ex-husband. Mm-hmm. I used to go down there occasionally. I'd been down to see things like Takis, who'd made these flashing lights and sold them for a fortune. You know, it'd be garbage. But they sent me this pamphlet, or he called me, I don't know which, about this Japanese girl from New York was going to be in a bag, you know, doing this event or happening. I thought, you know, sex. So I went down, and it was quite funny because I had a chauffeur-driven SS Cooper Mini with black windows. You know, the chauffeur was about 8 foot tall, and the Mini drives up, a giant guy gets out and opens the door, and I go in, and it's the night before the opening.
That was in the basement.
There was, you know, like a few nails on a stand and an apple on a stand, cosmic. And just these strange-looking objects, just looked like found objects that had been painted white with little messages written on them. John Dunbar sort of showing me around. I'm looking, thinking, what? How much is that? You know, £100 for a bag of nails? Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. How much is the apple? £200?
Fresh apple.
Oh, thanks a lot. £200 for a fresh apple? I thought, this is a con. What the hell is this, you know? I go downstairs and there's a few sort of... There must have been assistants, but I thought there was a minimal audience lying around on the floor. Anyway, but Dunbar's trying to hustle a bit because he thinks the millionaire Beatles are coming to buy, you know? So he introduces me to this strange-looking Japanese woman. Nothing's happening in the bags. I'm expecting an orgy. In a bag, something's going to be happening in a bag, you know, psychedelic. And it's all quiet. And he introduces me to her. And I said, well, where's the sort of happening, the event? And she gives me a little card. And it just says, breathe on it. So I said, you mean like that? She says, yeah, that's it. So I'm looking for action, you know, and I see this thing called hammer and nail in. It's a board with a chain and a hammer hanging on it and a bunch of nails at the bottom. I said, well, can I hammer a nail in? She says, no. So John Dunbar whisks her away.
This was before the opening, you know. I didn't want anybody to touch anything.
Right.
So
right.
He takes from the corner and says, that's a millionaire. Well, you know who that is? She didn't know who I was.
He didn't explain anything. He was just sort of trying to... hint, you know, with his eyes.
Well, whatever. She came over and says, you can hammer one in for 5 shillings. I said, I'll give you an imaginary 5 shillings and have an imaginary nail in, all right? And that's when we fell. Da-da-da-da-da.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Help me get my feet back on the ground.
It took months of friendship before John and Yoko became lovers. But when they did, they became inseparable soulmates. For years, John's life had revolved around the Beatles and his writing partner, Paul. Now John had a new creative collaborator, Yoko Ono. They made films together, music together, and campaigned for peace together. Their first major peace event was a 1969 bed-in at the Amsterdam Hilton the week following their marriage. It was their honeymoon. Several months later, they held another bed-in in Montreal and recorded the classic, Give Peace a Chance.
The point of the bed-in, in a nutshell, was a commercial for peace as opposed to a commercial for war, which was on the news every day those days, and the newspapers every day was dismembered bodies and napalm. And we thought, well, why don't they have something nice in the newspapers, that old thing, you know? And anyway, we did the bed-in. What the bed-in was 7 days, because the press were always asking questions. 7 days of they can ask anything, no secrets, you know. No time limit, like, you know, you come in, take the photographs, then the photographers go away, and then the press are allowed 10 minutes to ask. This was, you come in as long as you like, till you've got everything you need to know about John and Yoko, or what we stand for, or what we are. One of the most hysterical moments was the first day when we were sitting in the, you know, Amsterdam Hilton in the bed like two little kids, you know, with all the posters on the wall.
Flower children.
Flower kids or whatever. These guys were sweating to fight to get in first because they thought we were going to be making love in bed, you see. That's where their minds
were
at. Because we'd be naked, bed,
right.
John and Yoko, sex. So anyway, tried to do it in New York, but the American government wouldn't let us in. They knew we'd done it in Amsterdam, and they didn't want any peaceniks here, which is what we heard the department of whoever controls that said. But we ended up doing it in Montreal instead and broadcasting across the border, you see, and there was live riots at Berkeley at the bed-in in Amsterdam. But after answering all these questions many times, it got down to all we were saying was give peace a chance, not we have any formula or communism or socialism will answer it or any ism could answer it. We didn't have a format, we couldn't give you a plan.
But just sit
but
down.
But just consider
and think
the
about
idea
it.
Of not having this war. Just consider it.
By the time John led the recording of Give Peace a Chance, he'd already told Paul and the others that he wanted out of the Beatles. They would make one more album, Abbey Road, but to all those around him it was clear John was moving into a new stage in his development.
There's lots more to come as we continue our journey through John Lennon's life. In the next hour, we'll hear some of John's home recordings and sit in on a series of candid conversations which spanned the 70s. All that and more when we continue our journey through the lost Lennon tapes on the Westwood One Radio Network.